I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Sarah Abravaya Stein, author of Family Papers, A Sephardic Journey Through the 20th Century. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Our Shinshinim are young representatives of Israel, Shai Friedwald and Danielle Levy, and our Mavina on Israel, Imbal Shtivi. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. Today is the 14th of the Jewish calendar month of Shvat, which means tomorrow is the minor but important holiday of Tu B'Shvat, the Jewish New Year for trees. Tu B'Shvat's an annual reminder that in Jewish tradition we are the stewards of this earth that God created with a moral and ethical responsibility to preserve and protect it from destruction. The principle Bal Tashchit, to prevent physical destruction of nature, is enshrined in the Torah, and the mitzvah to work to engender a healthy planet is part of our eternal responsibility as Jews. Which makes this a complicated Tu B'Shvat for some of us. At a time when protecting the earth from the human-caused destruction of global warming is critical, we continue to see some of the most powerful people in our country, including the president, deny the very existence of what is so clearly occurring all across our planet. We are also seeing policies that protect the natural world, perhaps this beautiful country's greatest asset, being changed deliberately to allow environmental destruction in our national parks, to permit oil and mining companies to wreak havoc in the pursuit of profits. We have a profound responsibility embodied in this Jewish holiday that celebrates God's creation of nature and all growing living things to work to save our planet. Perhaps even more than in the horribly polluted days of the late 60s and early 70s, we've now reached a time when environmental destruction will become irreversible. On this Tu B'Shvat, which is tonight and tomorrow, each of us has the responsibility to choose to act to protect our earth rather than see it continue on a path towards destruction. And that message urgently needs to be conveyed to the leaders of this great nation. To play us in this morning, here's a Yiddish song that works for Tu B'Shvat, the classic Arum Dem Feuer, about sitting around the campfire, enjoying the outdoors.
Arum Dem Feuer, wir singen Lieder, die Nacht ist taie, man wird nicht wieder, soll das Feuer verloschen werden. Mit seine Stern. Doch grün die Kerbe, wir blumen lassen. Warum denn feiern wir freilich tanzen? Weil Tanz und Lied,
weil Tanz und Lied ist unser Leben.
Wer noch in Schloch, hallo im Schweben.
That was the group Spielberg singing Arum Dem Feuer for Tu B'Shvat, tonight and tomorrow. Our guest this morning, Professor Sarah Abravaya Stein, is the author of Family Papers, A Sephardic Journey Through the 20th Century, a vibrant book that chronicles the story of a large and complicated family from Thessaloniki and uses it to illustrate extraordinary truths about the Sephardic world. Learn about them when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson in the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha has moved to larger quarters in our new synagogue home, 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night at 2270 West Ina, just west of La Cholla. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah study weeklies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our new synagogue's at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. We're not in the mall, but on the south side in our own building. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Confirmation and High School programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and, of course, all of our services, go to www.BeitSimchaTucson.org. That's BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Sarah Abravaya Stein is Professor Maurice Amato Endowed Chairs in Sephardic Studies and the Sadie and Ludwig Kahn Director of the Alan D. Leave Center for Jewish Studies at UCLA. She has a fascinating new book, well, pretty new, 2019, that counts as new, Family Papers, A Sephardic Journey Through the 20th Century. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Just for general purposes, tell us a little bit about your own Sephardic heritage.
Well, I come from, like so many people, from a bit of a mixed and motley line. My maternal grandfather was born in Çanakkale, Turkey, which is just across the water from Gallipoli.
It is indeed. I've been there, by the way.
Oh, it's a lovely, lovely little...
beautiful little town. It really
yeah,
is.
Yeah, and his family was Sephardic. The language of the home was Ladino, and he and his siblings and his parents emigrated to New York when he was rather young, and then from New York to Los Angeles, where my mother grew up, in a Sephardic community that her family was incredibly devoted to. I myself grew up in Oregon, rather further afield from a Sephardic cultural center, but it has been an important part of my cultural braiding.
It's not like growing up in Salonika, for example.
Eugene, Oregon is not exactly like Salonika, but, you know.
Sort of like that. A little greener, more evergreens.
A little greener.
One of the, I think, deep misunderstandings for American Jews, if they know much about Sephardic culture, is they think it sort of ended in 1492. Obviously, that's not at all the case. Can you describe a little bit about how your journey commenced and what it meant to be Sephardic, say, at the beginning of the 20th century?
Sure. Well, the journey that took me to this book was a journey of digging for records, really. I had some years ago translated with a colleague what we understood to be the first memoir ever to be written in Ladino, Judeo-Spanish, the language of the Sephardic Jews of Southeastern Europe, the Ottoman lands, Turkey,
Balkans,
Greece, Anatolia.
Turkey, right,
exactly.
Of course.
Exactly. And when we finished that project, which was published as a book called A Jewish Voice from Ottoman Salonika, I became fascinated with the question of what happened to that family. The memoirist himself was a sort of cultural leader of 19th century Salonika and a printer and an editor and a publisher of newspapers, what in today's terms we might call a tastemaker. And I began to pursue the question of what had become of this family line, and worked my way backwards from the memoir itself, which had traveled rather extraordinarily from Ottoman Salonika to Paris to Rio de Janeiro to Jerusalem, where it was donated to an archive. And I worked my way backwards trying to find how this small notebook of a memoir had made that journey and what it could teach me about the family. And as I went, I discovered branches of this extraordinary family spread across the globe, from Brazil to India, England, France, Spain, Portugal, Canada, Israel. And what was incredibly surprising for a professional historian and someone who's really interested in unearthing neglected documents of the past, what was so surprising is that they maintained incredible collections of family papers. And many of these descendants were, you know, seventh generation descendants of this memoirist I described, are holding on to papers in languages they themselves can't read. So they were bound to these materials, even though in some way they were inaccessible to them. And so by using these family collections spread across the globe, coupled with things I dug up in what I would call a more formal archive, like a professional archive, dozens of those around the world, I was able to tell the history which I tell in family papers, which is the history of a single family over the arc of a century and through multiple generations and a dizzying array of global migrations.
It's a fascinating story. We will talk much more with Professor Sarah Abravaya-Stein. We'll return in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. Kirk Douglas, one of the most beloved tough guys in Hollywood history on screen, and a defender of blacklisted artists off screen, died last week at the age of 103.
All men lose when they die. All men die, but a slave and a free man lose different things.
They both lose life.
Free man dies, he loses the pleasure of life. Slave loses its pain. Death is the only freedom a slave knows. That's why he's not afraid of it. That's why we'll win.
Michael Douglas, the actor's Oscar-winning son, announced his death on behalf of the family. To the world, he was a legend, an actor from the golden age of movies who lived well into his golden years, a humanitarian whose commitment to justice and the causes he believed in set a standard for all of us to aspire to, said Michael about his famous father. Kirk Douglas, who bravely and publicly fought his way back from a severe stroke in 1996, will be remembered for the grit and determination he showed on screen in action epics like Spartacus and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, biopics like Lust for Life, and more intimate character studies like Lonely Are the Brave. But his commitment to higher ideals in the film industry proved even more dramatic. Douglas was responsible for helping break Hollywood's infamous blacklist at the height of the Cold War paranoia. He was instrumental in hiring and crediting the legendary screenwriter Dalton Trumbo, a member of the so-called Hollywood Ten, for his work on Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus. I'm Spartacus. I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus. I'm Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus.
He was also a committed philanthropist. I've known Kirk Douglas personally and appreciate his friendship, said President Jimmy Carter when he awarded Douglas the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor, in 1981. I have known how dedicated he is to using his talent as an actor and director and the esteem with which he's held by his own people in spreading the good news about this country and explaining our purposes, ideals, commitments, and achievements, our hopes and dreams to people around the world. Kirk Douglas's progressive values were the product of his upbringing as the poor child of Jewish immigrants from what's now Belarus. His birth name was Isser Danilovich. He grew up in Amsterdam, New York. a Navy veteran during World War II, he cut his teeth as a stage actor before scoring strong supporting roles in classic films like Out of the Past. Douglas emerged as a star in the 1949 boxing drama Champion, for which he earned the first of three Academy Award nominations for Best Actor. He got a Lifetime Achievement Oscar in 1996. In that film and subsequent hits, Douglas broke with the tradition of unflappable leading men by portraying complex and often morally conflicted characters who tested audiences' sympathies. In tough, trenchant films like Ace in the Hole, Paths of Glory, and 7 Days in May, Kirk Douglas didn't shy away from challenging subject matter like corruption of the press or military. Douglas pursued his passions without sacrificing popular appeal. He was ranked among the top 25 box office stars for 6 straight years, starting in 1957, and the cleft-chin star remained a virile sex symbol well into his 60s. The pace Kirk Douglas kept as a perpetual A-lister took a toll on his relationship with his family. He split from Michael Douglas's mother when his famous son was just 6 years old. He was a rager early on. He was overworked. He was doing 5-plus pictures a year, Michael Douglas said. But over the years, the two stars repaired their relationship and even appeared alongside each other with Kirk's embattled grandson Cameron in the 2003 drama It Runs in the Family. And he stood by Michael's side when he battled stage 4 cancer in 2010. Kirk Douglas also began blogging in his 90s, attracting a new generation of fans. He wrote 11 novels and memoirs, and his 12th book, Kirk and Anne, Letters of Love, Laughter, and a Lifetime in Hollywood, co-written with his wife of 62 years, Anne, was published in 2017 when he was a mere 100 years old. Kirk Douglas received a standing ovation at the 2018 Golden Globe Awards, sharing the spotlight with daughter-in-law Catherine Zeta-Jones, who presented his award. May his memory only bring blessing. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about how we respond to this rise in anti-Semitism and how some of the lessons from around the world may help us here in America in addressing it. We talked a little bit about kind of the hardening of targets, which is really just a way of responding to potential individual incidents. And then last week you mentioned the remarkable effect in North Africa of really positive reinforcement from the highest levels of king leadership of the importance of the Jewish community, the centrality of the Jewish community to cultures that we wouldn't think of as being positive towards Jews.
Right, such as Ukraine.
Such as Ukraine, where Zelensky, you know, was elected. They've got a Jewish prime minister. You think that might increase anti-Semitism, and the opposite is taking
place.
Well,
it turns out sometimes that sometimes familiarity breeds contempt, and sometimes it doesn't. And one of the things in countries with old-fashioned, ingrained anti-Semitism is that most people have never seen a Jew. And so when there's a Jew on TV or radio every day, and he or she is making sense, they begin to change their understanding of what a Jew is. Maybe less different from you and me, not so alien, not the other with a capital O, and that's all to the good. I think just exposure to Jews, positive contact with Jews, does a lot to remove the causes or the sources of anti-Semitism. So I think active engagement with non-Jews and inclusion and stuff like, I mean, my family always had non-Jews at the Seder table.
Yeah,
stuff
absolutely.
Like that is helpful to combating anti-Semitism.
You know, it's funny, I wrote an article about that recently in the local Tucson paper about exactly that. You need to build those relationships, cultivate the other religious communities all around you, because when the chips are down, those are the people that will step forward and support you.
Right. I think another thing...
That's not the only reason to do it,
right,
but it's a good reason.
And please don't shoot me for saying this, but I think another thing is we have to know more about who we are. The quality of Jewish education or knowledgeability about our own heritage has to improve, because otherwise, when there is contact between a Jew and a non-Jew, the Jew may unknowingly just reinforce old stereotypes. Like, you know, I just had a conversation 2 days ago with a woman who thought the only reason for the Jewish dietary laws was health concerns in the Middle East, where there was no refrigeration 3,000 years ago, and that none of those laws have any validity and they're just silly. Well, misconceptions like that, or lacunae in the understanding of Jewish heritage, Jewish law, Jewish history, does not help to overcome anti-Semitism. It, in fact, helps perpetuate it.
Right. Yeah, I think that's right. You're really going to get an objection from a rabbi when you say that there should be better Jewish education and self-knowledge. Yes, of course. I'm gonna criticize you for saying that. It's funny because I think Jewish pride and knowledge are central to combating anti-Semitism. If you accept that we're somehow weird or inferior, you've bought into the most anti-Semitic comments of all.
Look, and a lot of universal humanist values, a lot of so-called the Abrahamic religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, those universal values came from us.
They're
ours, we gave them to the world.
Yes.
But most Jews don't know that.
No, I think that's right. So a combination of knowledge and self-knowledge and self-pride in your own Judaism is a very important element in turning this unfortunate tide, which has been surging. Tom, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shlicha for Israel, our Mivinar, expert on Israel, Inbal Shtivi, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Inbal.
Boker Tov.
And Chag Sameach, Tu B'Shvat, you know.
Definitely.
A minor Jewish holiday, but an important one, the New Year for trees. So Israel is famous because of those blue and white pushkas that they had all around the world in which you put your coins in to plant trees in Israel, to reforest Israel.
Yes, definitely.
And they planted trees.
They still do.
And they still do,
yeah.
Right? Especially if there's a fire or something, they plant trees.
Definitely.
But a lot of the trees they planted weren't actually the right kind of trees, and they had nothing to do with Israel. And
some of them did, some of them didn't. The eucalyptus is the major example of
my favorite Israeli song, maybe, is Horshat Eucalyptus, about, you know, the beautiful... The eucalyptus trees and the smell of the salt, and you're like, those are Australian trees.
Yeah, they
How
are
did they
Australian.
Get to Israel? They suck up water like a sponge.
But that's why they came there
to drain the swamps.
They right. actually, I don't know if you know the Chula Valley.
Beautiful Chula Valley. One of the most fertile places in all of Israel.
One of the most fertile places and a hotspot for cranes. Coming from south
to
north,
so
I was there just a while ago, and it's amazing to see thousands and thousands of those pink birds, large birds. We don't get to see them so often.
Right.
None of us gets to see them so often.
It's on the migratory path between Africa and Asia or Europe.
The far north, Russia, kind of area. So that's why the eucalyptus got there in the first place. Yoel Moshe Salomon and all of his friends. It's a different song, but never mind. Those that found Chula Valley
right.
when they came to Israel decades ago, 100 years ago.
We're talking about a century ago.
Saw a swamp full of flies and other diseases. And back then,
mosquitoes, malaria, everything.
Right. And back then, no one knew that a swamp is actually its own habitat, and that the flies deserve to live, just like your horse or your cattle or your sheep, or whatever it is you're trying to, goats. So that kind of awareness was not there. So they immediately brought the first thing that they thought of, which is the eucalyptus, because it is known that the eucalyptus is sucking up water. It is known that it will dry your land. Well, it did.
Yeah.
It dried up Chula. Only in recent decades or years, they started to recreate the Chula Valley, the swamps, and deliver water.
So that the birds would come back and have a place to stop on the migratory route.
So that the birds will have place, so that the entire ecosystem surrounding it will continue to live. So the eucalyptus is very popular in Israel. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also think when I was living in Jerusalem, they had those wonderful Jerusalem pines that they planted. Mm-hmm. And then one winter it snowed.
Yeah.
And it broke all the branches. They went down on the power lines. It knocked out the power for the whole city of Jerusalem because they're really not the right trees for that area either.
Actually, pines have a specific trait to them. The pine itself, the sting, the leaf itself,
right,
is not allowing, when it drops on the ground, it's not doing good to the soil.
It doesn't biodegrade into the soil. It leaves all kinds of
it's
residues.
Not the kind of, it's not the kind of leaf that will
build your
fertile
topsoil, right?
Yeah,
right.
It's on the contrary, it poisons it. So when you're only a certain type of growth can happen beneath a pine tree.
A pine tree, right.
So you see, so we have a lot of pine trees, but not too much grass.
Yeah.
Making a long story short. Yeah, actually, when here in Tucson, it's quite amazing to see how the environment is, or at least most of it, mm-hmm, is kept with the
natural
trees.
Right.
Most of it is natural endemic trees. Most of it is natural, and also the low light policy is interesting. In Israel, it doesn't happen like that.
No, I think Tel Aviv has plenty of too much light.
But I think it's also specific to Tucson. Vegas.
It's partly.
We went to Vegas.
Yeah, I don't think Vegas has a low light.
My God, the amount of light over there.
Absurd.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of trees.
Chag Sameach, and eat dried fruit. That's the habit.
Absolutely. We'll talk next week.
Bye-bye.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. At the funeral of the richest man in town, a stranger saw a woman crying loudly. The stranger asked, "Are you a relative of the deceased?" "No," she said. "Then why are you crying?" he asked. And she answered, "That's why." That was the old Jewish joke of the week special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shinim, our young experts on Israel, Danielle Levy and Shai Friedwald from the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So you guys were back in Israel recently. You'd been away for like 6 months, right? So it's the first time you've ever been away for 6 months. Mm-hmm. Well, Danielle, you lived in Germany. I shouldn't say
but
that.
But it was with my family. So.
But you were with your family and you were young and so on. Now you have another? Oh, very sweet. So, what was the experience like for you? What were the surprises? What were the disappointments? What were the wonderful things about
it? Let's say literally when we went out from the plane, we went to the immigration.
At Ben Gurion, right?
Yeah. A lot of speedings, a lot of
just rude
cursing, a lot of pushing in the line.
Boy, that sounds like Israel to me.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
After coming from Tucson, that people I hear just like one of the most kindest and nicest people I've met coming back to Israel. And I remember this one, you don't have an organized line. So I was like, not pushing, but you have to kind of push to get where we want to get.
If you don't push, you're never going to get to the front of the line. Everybody else is going to get ahead of you.
And this one woman was pushing me back and I was telling Shai, wow, I missed this. And she was like, yeah, if you would have been like nicer, you wouldn't have missed this or something. I'm like, oh, it's good to be back. What a nice welcome.
I used to say the one word that Israelis don't know is slicha, which means excuse me, sorry.
Yeah,
you never hear it there.
No.
It's one of the first things we teach kids here, not how it's used there. So that's the first thing, just the general quality of people or the attitude, right? You're pushy, those pushy Jews in Israel, I'm telling you. So what other observations, what other surprises?
So I felt kind of, let's not say stupid, but it's all the stuff that we missed here for the past 6 months, not having. And for example, I asked my parents to bring me schnitzel to the airport because I have like an hour and a half drive back home. So I couldn't wait. I wanted to eat it immediately.
You wanted to eat the schnitzel in the car on the way back to Emek
Israel. That's exactly what I did. And my mom was like, since when do you like schnitzel that much? I'm like, are you kidding? I haven't eaten it in like 6 months. I appreciate it so much more now. I missed it so much. And she just didn't get it.
It's the food, right? So Shai, you know, cottage is like the most basic food in Israel. It's like cottage
really
cheese.
Really basic, yeah.
Tastes like nothing, frankly.
That's what you think.
You have a story about that.
Yes, my mom used to make for me for school sandwiches with cottage every day for 4 years, and I didn't like it, but I had to eat it.
She made it for you. What are you gonna do?
All right. And now when I came home, so I ate a whole package of cottage, and it was like kind of good. And also, yeah,
there are many Israeli foods that are fantastic.
Right,
cottage is not one of them.
Not one of them.
But
absolutely.
But you know, you missed it. It was home. Right, the taste of home.
Right. Also, as the minute then I went out from my neighborhood, I heard 6 times of honkings than I hear here in 6 months.
Yeah. Yep. And I always say that in Israel, the brake and the horn are connected.
Right.
If you step on the brake, you honk.
You honk. Exactly. One more. I think the thinking about the missing family and friends, as I saw them, it felt like I saw them yesterday. Because here, if I really care about them, so they accompanied me by thinking of them and by remember all the things that they taught me and told me to do. And like,
so maybe you can go home again.
Huh? Yeah, yeah, I can go home again.
Yeah, and Danielle, like we never left.
Yeah, I was going to say, did it feel really just like everything was the same?
Absolutely. And my friend said the same. Like, you never change. Beside a few pounds that I gained, I was exactly the same.
Oh, yeah. I should have warned you about that in America. Our food is not nearly as healthy, and you don't walk nearly as much. You got to watch that. We will talk to you next week. Thanks so much, Lehi Trauk.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. A question. Can you recite the Ten Commandments by heart? I suspect not. Most of us can't. We usually remember thou shalt not murder, usually misstated as thou shalt not kill, and thou shalt not steal. Most people remember there's something in there about honoring father and mother. Others get the adultery part, or perhaps even the Sabbath. Few remember all 10. But whether we know them by heart or not, these 10 statements from this week's Torah portion of Yitro are supposed to be the only words God ever spoke directly to our whole people. But they are not really at the heart of our Judaism today. Why not? In point of fact, we liberal Jews have trouble with many of the 10, struggling to find relevant ways to observe them. Nearly every commandment brings with it a problem, even the most positively phrased. What does it mean to remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy if we spend most of Shabbat working? Nearly all the commandments have complications. How are we to suitably honor fathers and mothers if they are challenging people or even abusive? Not murdering or stealing seems clear enough, but how can we possibly avoid being jealous of our neighbor's better job or nicer car? And don't we take God's name in vain all the time without apparent repercussion? But I believe the commandment we have the gravest difficulty observing among Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, Progressive, Renewal, and all other non-Orthodox Jews is actually the first one. It is the simple statement that there is a God who commands us at all. Classically, this first statement, which contains no apparent commandment, has been considered by Christians a kind of preamble to the Ten Commandments. But we Jews always insisted on viewing it as a unique and critical first statement. Why? It's because, as logical as the Aseret HaDibrot may seem as a declaration of ethics, if we do not accept the existence of a mitzaveh, commander, they essentially lose their power. With no mitzaveh, no commander, there is no mitzuveh, no recipient of command. In practical terms, no real mitzvot, no commandments to be kept at all. In philosophical terms, the warrant for the authority of the Ten Commandments lies in this simple statement. God exists, God acts, God commands. It is why they are not called the Ten Suggestions, or the Ten Recommendations, or the Ten Nice Ideas, if you can manage them. It's only when we accept the existence of God, when we diminish our own elaborate sense of self, that we are able to partner with God to create a moral world. Only when we engage with the commander do we find the commandments. It is up to us on this week of Parshat Yitro to find for ourselves the one who commanded them, however we conceive of the Holy One, and to accept our role as recipients of ethical commandment. When we choose to do so, we'll find that then we can be moral beings. We can shape this world in good ways. We can observe the Ten Commandments just as they were intended to be observed. by, and from the heart. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Sarah Abravaya-Stein, will continue our voyage through the remarkable Sephardic world of the 20th century, including discussing a great Jewish villain of World War II. Find out about him and much more when we return in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Fred Silverman, the most important TV figure of the 1970s, who picked shows like All in the Family, The Waltons, Charlie's Angels, Roots, and Hill Street Blues, and who was the only executive ever to head programming for CBS, ABC, and NBC, died last week at the age of 82.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made. Those were the days.
Perhaps the most influential single executive in TV history, Silverman gave David Letterman his first TV show, orchestrated popular spin-offs The Jeffersons, Rhoda, Laverne and Shirley, The Bionic Woman and The Facts of Life, brought Jiggle TV series like Charlie's Angels and Three's Company to the airwaves, and presided over Real People, the first hit show to bring a news mentality to entertainment, foreshadowing reality TV. Silverman honed his skills working on kids' shows. He came up with Scooby-Doo. Game shows, he resurrected The Price is Right and launched Family Feud. And daytime TV, under his watch, All My Children and General Hospital targeted successfully younger viewers. At CBS, Silverman jettisoned rural comedies like The Beverly Hillbillies and Petticoat Junction in favor of smarter shows like All in the Family and MASH. He later took the beleaguered ABC network to number one in prime time. He shifted to NBC in 1978 with total oversight of the whole company. While Fred Silverman was engineering the turnaround at ABC, Time magazine put him on a cover in September 1977 with the line, TV's Master Showman. The accompanying article quoted an ABC exec calling him the man with the golden gut. To this day, it still haunts me, said Silverman. In 2001, it has nothing to do with the gut. It really has a lot to do with a very high learning curve. You learn from experience. Soon after Silverman failed to turn around NBC and acrimoniously departed in 81, he launched his own company, which produced Matlock and Diagnosis Murder. Fred Silverman was born in 1937 in New York City and raised in Queens. His father was a Jewish TV and radio repairman for Sears. Young Fred collected radio scripts. At one point, he had 5,000. Silverman went to Syracuse University. He was a member of AE Pi fraternity and then got his master's in TV at Ohio State. He wanted to be a director, but an advisor suggested another livelihood. So you really ought to consider programming, Silverman recalled. It requires a real knowledge of the business. It's kind of creative because you're picking the shows. His first job was editing commercials. Silverman later oversaw Bozo's Circus, then found unlikely success with a heavily promoted block of Bomba the Jungle Boy films. That was a case of packaging, he said, and really good marketing to take crap and make it look like gold. It's something that came in very handy later on when I went to work at the networks. Silverman left in 1963 for a New York TV station. 6 weeks later, then 25 years old, he moved to CBS as director of daytime programs. Silverman had an idea for a surefire Saturday morning hit, a cartoon about kids and a dog in a haunted house that referenced movies like Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. CBS execs, however, thought the show would scare youngsters. On a flight to California, Silverman got an idea. As we're going in for the landing, Frank Sinatra comes on and I hear him sing, Doobie-doobie-doo, he recalled. At that point, I said, we'll take the dog, we'll call him Scooby-Doo, move him up front, it'll be a dog show. Our Abbott and Costello will be Scooby-Doo and Shaggy. In 2 hours, we revised the concept.
Hey, Scooby!
The show debuted in September 1969 to a huge audience share. 1970, Silverman was put in charge of everything on the air at CBS. We had an old schedule directed at old people in rural areas, he said. Our company-owned stations in New York, Chicago, and L.A. were dying. Something had to be done. twice, ABC had passed on pilots for All in the Family, but when Silverman saw it, I couldn't believe what I was seeing, he said. Compared to the crap we were canceling, this was setting new boundaries. For All in the Family's second season, CBS chairman William Paley wanted the comedy buried Monday night at 10:30. But Fred Silverman convinced CBS to shift All in the Family and the Mary Tyler Moore Show to Saturdays, then had MASH move from Saturdays to Tuesdays as centerpiece of another strong night. Soon, CBS was thriving, helped by Maude, the Jeffersons, Good Times, One Day at a Time, all from Norman Lear, producer of All in the Family, the Bob Newhart Show and Rhoda, both from MTM, the company behind the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and new shows like Kojak and the Waltons, which was spawned from a 1971 telefilm. My wife said, "That was a really good film. Why don't you order some episode scripts?" Silverman said. By 1975, CBS was riding high, and at that point, to stick around, there really wasn't an upside, Silverman said, so he left to become president of ABC. Helped by Michael Eisner, whom Silverman called the best executive I ever worked with, he resurrected a project in development and made a pilot for a new show called Charlie's Angels, starring Farrah Fawcett, Jacqueline Smith, and Kate Jackson.
Once upon a time, there were three little girls who went to the police academy.
Critics lambasted the show as jiggle TV, but Silverman said Charlie's Angels was a positive statement for the women's movement. This was the first show where there were three women running things and doing things on their own. He greenlit shows like The Love Boat, Fantasy Island, Donnie and Marie, and The Bawdy Soap, which had the first openly gay character on network TV, played by young comedian Billy Crystal. And then he okayed 12 hours of the miniseries Roots, which changed TV dramatically. Fred Silverman brought a sense of showmanship and some pizzazz to ABC, he said. The network schedule was very bright, kind of sparkled. We had the best new stars in their late 20s and early 30s. In 1978, he jumped to NBC as president and CEO, reporting only to the chairman of RCA. He promoted comedy head Brandon Tartikoff to programming. One of the first shows he put on the schedule was Different Strokes, then launched the spinoff The Facts of Life. He gave a commitment to a new show, Cheers, and commissioned George Slatter to produce Real People, which became a number one show. Silverman had the idea for Hill Street Blues. He envisioned it as Barney Miller as a drama. I had just seen the movie Fort Apache, and I said, if we can do a show like that, it'll be a big hit. And it was, created by Stephen Bochco and Michael Kozol. Fred Silverman met David Letterman when the comic was emceeing an event. They had a chat outside the men's room, and he decided Letterman should be on the air. The David Letterman Show debuted in the mornings on NBC. The ratings were poor, and Silverman canceled it, but decided, this is my error, not David Letterman's, and signed him to a major deal, a $1 million guarantee a year. Letterman, of course, went on to host Late Night, which aired after The Tonight Show. Fred Silverman was inducted in the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Hall of Fame back in 1999. He's probably now programming for the big network in the sky. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Sarah Bravaya Stein, Professor Maurice Amato Endowed Chairs in Sephardic Study, and Sadie and Ludwig Kahn, Director of the Alan D. Leave Center for Jewish Studies at UCLA. Boy, that's a lot. She has written extensively, a professional historian. She's won two National Jewish Book Awards, the Sammy Rohr Prize for Jewish Literature, a Guggenheim Fellowship, UCLA Distinguished Teaching Award. And by the way, that is, of course, the best university in the world, my alma mater. Anyway, we started talking about Family Papers, A Sephardic Journey Through the 20th Century, and the arc of this family that you follow through the 20th century. I guess I have to ask about the period of the Shoah. Having been in Thessaloniki, which is what Salonika is called now, that it's under Greece, and seen, you know, the remnants of what was once a tremendous Jewish community, but still an active one. The story of Vital Hasson, the Jew who worked with the Nazis, can you tell us a little bit about how you discovered that, because that's kind of a forgotten aspect of all this.
It is such a painful story. Well, I should say, first of all, that what some of your listeners may not know is that the devastation for the Jewish community of Salonika, which was once thriving Jewish center, and in fact, one of the rare cities of the modern world to have a majority Jewish population, the rate of annihilation by the Nazis during the Second World War of this community and of Greek Jewry in general is astonishingly high. The numbers of those lost is not as high as in a huge demographic center like Warsaw, but in terms of the percentage of destruction, it is among the very highest of any location, 98%, yeah, roughly. As I followed this family through the 20th century, of course, I appreciated that there would be devastation in the family's history, and indeed there was all of the tragedies that we imagine unearthing when we think about the Jewish experiences of the Second World War in general, not just Sephardic ones, ghettoization and spoliation and forced labor and gassing in death camps and medical experiments. I mean, all of the tragedies that we know the broad contours of, but that continue to amaze us when we hear individual stories. So I had braced for that, and indeed I uncovered all of that, although I must say that the Sephardic experience of the Holocaust has been relatively understudied. So though those of us who are attached to these communities or are historians ourselves appreciate the scale of this devastation, it's quite amazing that it still remains relatively unknown for a broader Jewish public. In any case, I was prepared for that. What I was not prepared was to discover that a member of this family had abetted the Nazi deportations and annihilation of Jewish Salonika by serving as the head of the Jewish police, by a man by the name of Vital Hassan, who was, by all accounts, and there are many accounts in testimonies in Greek, in Ladino, in French, in Hebrew, held by collections of testimonies the world over. By all of these accounts, he was a vicious sadist whose crimes were incredibly excessive. And after the war, he proved to be the only Jew in all of Europe who is tried by a state, that state is Greece, found guilty for collaboration with the Nazis and executed for his crimes. So this is a stunning discovery that the family was unaware of, I have to make clear. The living members of the family were unaware of. Their forebearers were, at a certain generational level, did know of this story, but it was quite thoroughly buried, I think, both emotionally, for understandable reasons, and also practically, in the sense that they never wrote about it. He was removed from family trees. Documentation was destroyed that referred to his crimes. So it was a history that really had been erased from family consciousness.
You know, it's kind of a way of working into this backwards, but Salonika was maybe the most diverse city in the Mediterranean. Such a complicated and fascinating place, a great Jewish publishing center, a cultural center. That destruction kind of highlights what an incredible place it was. In your research, how much have you discovered about that? How much of that really still exists?
I'll try to answer both of those questions. One of the things that was so challenging about unearthing the story of Vital Hassan was because I didn't want it to overwhelm a longer history, a longer intimate family history of this clan, but also of this community. And you're right, Salonika was an exceptional community, although it had parallels in the Mediterranean and Middle Eastern Jewish world in terms of its diversity and cultural vivacity. But it was an internally diverse Jewish community, by which I mean that there were Sephardic Jews, such as I've described, but there were also Ashkenazi Jews, there were Italian Jews, there were, of course, many non-Jews, Muslims, and Dunme. Dunme are the descendants of Jews who followed Shabbatai Tzvi, proclaimed the Messiah into Islam when he converted in the 17th century. There were Greek Orthodox and there were Christians. Salonika had more than 50 synagogues in its day, and it was so Jewish in its cultural and demographic and also mercantile fabric that the whole city shut down on the Jewish Sabbath and the port came to a halt. So this was a city. It was an Ottoman city. It was a port city. It was, in some sense, a cosmopolitan city, but it was also very much a Jewish city. And that imprint, that watermark upon the city was simply undeniable for much of its modern history until roughly the middle of the 20th century. And the Jewish presence starts to wane before the Holocaust through a series of disasters, through emigration, through a demographic remapping of Salonika. These are all sort of complicated issues we can talk about or not. But the point is that vibrant community was already becoming a minority community even before the devastation of the Second World War.
In creating this, but it's so fascinating, we think about illiterate people as being voiceless, right? What a fascinating way to kind of recover a voice like that. How much integrity is there to the family today?
Well, I'm not quite sure how to understand the word integrity.
Oh, sorry.
Coherent as a family?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a fascinating journey, and it goes all over the world. Are they still close? Do they still?
It's a really interesting question, and yeah, it's actually the question I end the book with, which is to ask myself not only what does family mean, but when, if ever, does family cease becoming family because the branches of the tree extend so broadly? What I write in that conclusion is that today these reaching branches of the family tree, once the Levy family tree, but now, of course, it holds many, many names, they are each incredibly vivacious and mostly Jewish, but not entirely Jewish. They have been generous to me. They have welcomed me into their homes. They are all committed to their history. But of course, inevitably, at a certain point, they cease to think of one another as family. And that cessation had a number of reasons. It was partly time. It was partly geography. I also think, as I suggest in the end of the book, it was also that at a certain point, the cousins who had all grown up in the same milieu of Salonika, when they lost the tie of the city that once bound them, and they stopped writing letters. That was really crucial to me, thinking about the role of letters. And their children ceased to write letters to one another. The letters had been a kind of glue that bound them together, even more powerful than blood or faith. The letters had bound them together. And so inevitably, at a point, they ceased to think of one another as family. However, what is a very interesting postscript to this question is that now that the book has been published, I am finding that the different branches of the family cast across the world are reaching out to one another, and in some cases having reunions because of this book, and I guess because of their relationship with me. And now the family is experiencing a new chapter, which is really interesting to watch unfold, a new chapter of connection.
What a fascinating result. What a mitzvah, actually, you've done.
Thank you.
I have a last question. Are your books automatically finalists for the National Jewish Book Award every time you publish one?
I have been incredibly blessed to have a lot of my books recognized by the National Jewish Book Council, which distributes the National Jewish Book Awards. And this one, as well, was named a finalist, for which I'm really very honored.
It's such a pleasure. Where can people go to find out more about you and your books?
Well, kind of you to ask. I welcome people to take a peek at my website, sarahabrevias-stein.com, to follow the book. You can buy it wherever books are sold, wherever your local independent bookshop can be found. And for the masochists among you, I'm on Twitter at Sarah A. Stein. And mostly I would say just take a look at the book and do enjoy.
It's a terrific book. It reads, you know, there's so many different ways of writing history, but and great ways of writing history, but it's a charming and elegant way to present it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish will be Professor Ruth Weiss, the towering Jewish intellectual, author of the newly released paperback version of the seminal book, Jews and Power. Our playout this morning comes from Thessaloniki, the Jewish community of Salonika, in honor of our guest today. It's the classic Ala Una Yonasi, a courting song in Ladino. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Ala Una Yonasi, Ala Zos Metratesi, Ala Stresni Amante, Ala Squadra Mekasi.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.